009, 500 milligram dose administered. Experiment begins. Of pupils. Inducing stage two.
Speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, welcome to my science project for April 3rd, 2008. My name is Anne, and I'm the Vancouver host of the show. For those of you regulars, you know that I'm alternating shows with Julia, who's out of Calgary, and she'll be with you in a couple weeks' time. But you got me today, and like I said, my name's Anne, and today I've got more about octopus. Had a great little story for you last week about the hexapus, and I'm going to follow that up with a little bit more. And I know I left you hanging last show, and I know that because I got an irate phone call as soon as the show ended, and I left you hanging with a joke by not telling a joke. So the story last week was about this place called the Laugh Lab. It's thelaughlab.co.uk, and they did extensive research on jokes and what the funniest jokes are. So just to recap from that, it's a study from 2002 that was led by psychologist Richard Wiseman. He was on a mission to find the funniest joke. And so to do that, he solicited jokes from all around the world. Now, a number of jokes had to be excluded for rude or offensive language because they did have a criteria that all the jokes had to be repeatable to 10-year-olds. Nevertheless, they collected some 40,000 jokes from different countries. And then those jokes were rated on a 5-point scale by a wide range of judges. And the study revealed some interesting cultural differences. I mentioned a lot of these last week, but just to remind you, the study showed that North Americans, just like you and I, generally prefer jokes that involve someone else looking stupid, while those of you from Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom, Ireland included, tend to prefer jokes that are plays upon words. And yet many European countries prefer those surreal jokes. And joke telling was all but absent in Japan. In terms of the joke judges, Germans tended to give jokes the highest rating overall, so they seem to be the most appreciative of a good laugh. One thing that did come out of this study was the funniest animal. So if you want to make a joke, make it about a duck, because apparently ducks are funny animals. Now, I ran out of time the last show, so I wasn't able to deliver the best joke, and I'm no stand-up comedian, but here is the funniest joke of all time, according to Richard Wiseman and the Laugh Lab. It goes something like this. A couple of New Jersey hunters were out in the woods when one of them falls to the ground. He doesn't seem to be breathing, and his eyes are rolled back in his head. The other guy whips out his cell phone and calls the emergency services. He gasps to the operator, "My friend is dead. What can I do?" The operator, in a calm, soothing voice, says, "Just take it easy. I can help you. First, let's make sure he's dead." There's a silence, then a shot is heard. Then the guy comes back on the line and he says, "Okay, now what?" So there you have it. Apparently the funniest joke of all time. Use it, make it yours. For now, here's Bob Dylan. Takes a lot to laugh.
time is coming. The windows are filled with frost. I went to tell everybody, but I could not get across. Well, I wanna be your lover, baby. I don't wanna be your boss. Don't say I never warned you when your train gets lost.
If you're a film addict, a festival addict, or an art addict, then we've got the place for you to be. It's the Vancouver Student Film Festival.
What makes this festival different from any other is that it's all about students, and of course, their films. You'll get to see the work made by some of the people who'll be ruling the industry in the near future.
The concept behind the festival is to promote the already vibrant community of young Canadian filmmakers in British Columbia by showcasing the films of students and recent graduates from post-secondary film institutions, and thus enhancing the lines of communication that currently exist between the artist, the public, and fellow colleagues on the West Coast.
The third annual Vancouver Student Film Festival will take place on Saturday, May 24th, 2008 at the VIFC Van City Theatre. For more info, please visit the website at www.vsff.com.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden, in the shade. I'd ask my friend to come and see an octopus's garden with me. I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
Listen to My Science Project on CITR, and last week we had quite a story for you about the hexapus, or the six-legged octopus. And the octopus stories abound, because this week we have one that reveals that octopi live in quite kinky communities. And this is a study out of UC Berkeley that claims that the octopi, let's call them, are famous for violent murders and famous for jealousy and also famous for once-in-a-lifetime sex. So typically an octopus in captivity tends to be a bit of a loner. But these marine biologists argue that after watching the Abdopus aculeatus octopus in the wild, that in fact that they're not loners at all. They can be picky, they can be macho, they can be jealous. The male octopus carefully selects a mate and brings her home and then carefully guards their domesticated digs. And they do that so jealously that they would occasionally use their long tentacles to strangle a romantic rival to death. And as if that wasn't enough, a sneaker octopus was discovered who would deliberately hide their male stripings swim in a female style and try to poach a lover or two. And it turns out with these octopus that size does matter, but it's not exactly how you might think. It's the female who is selected based on size, because a larger female who is partnered will be able to produce even more eggs. These findings will be published in the Journal of Marine Biology. Under the sea, in an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you. So that was The Beatles with Octopus's Garden, a little soundtrack to my little octopus story. Earlier in the show, you heard Bob Dylan with It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry. And right at the top of the show, we were a little delayed getting started because the computer crashed, which is always a good time. But first tune you heard at the top of the show was Experiment Number 6 from Lemon Jelly. So coming up right now, I have a podcast that comes out of UBC. And it is called Saving Tuna, Lessons from Cod Mismanagement. So we're going to keep with that underwater theme. And you're going to hear this particular podcast that comes from the AAAS, which is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And this was a news briefing in Boston in which UBC professor Danny Pauly participated, along with a number of others, to discuss the possible extinction of tuna. And a lot of that can be blamed on the sushi industry. Now, I'm not going to get into it too much myself because it's very well introduced and described in this podcast. So take a listen.
This podcast is coming to you from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. For more UBC podcasts and more UBC, go to www.ubc.ca.
The following podcast is Saving Tuna, Lessons from Cod Mismanagement, February 18, 2008, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science News Briefing in Boston, Massachusetts, where UBC Professor Daniel Pauly joined Stanford's Barbara Block, World Wildlife Fund's Jose Inglis, and UBC Professor Rashid Samaya in arguing that tuna may follow cod to possible extinction unless we change how we approach managing both migratory species and the broader ecosystem they inhabit. Pauly introduces the overall issues. Block argues that the sushi economy is pushing tuna to the brink of collapse. Inglis asks governments and NGOs to help protect juvenile tuna in the Coral Triangle area by removing fish aggregation devices and implementing transboundary marine parks. And Samaya posits the question, whose fish are we eating, ours or grandchildren's? And says we must act now as if we are negotiating with future generations on catch levels in order to tackle the problem of overfishing.
Welcome, everybody, to the last press conference of the AAAS in this wonderful city of Boston. We have the theme today is how to save tuna. We have four speakers. One is Daniel Pauly from the University of Columbia, Vancouver. The second will be Barbara Block of Stanford University. The third will be Jose Inglis of the World Wildlife Fund in the Philippines. And the fourth will be Rashid Samaya of the University of British Columbia, again in Vancouver. I will ask the speakers to restate their name and affiliation for the benefit of those of you who are taping this. And I will ask Daniel to begin. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Daniel Pauly, of the Director of the Fishery Center in the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And this parallel session on cod and tuna. And before we had this session, we were asked, what do they have in common? What brings you together, researchers on cod and researchers on tuna, together? And they have, because usually you don't cook dishes where these two things come together. So, first of all, they are both extremely abundant. There's one species of cod. You can perhaps also considered a relative, but it's essentially a species, Atlantic cod, which in the North Atlantic has shaped the fate of entire civilization. For example, Norway and the North Sea also, and also Iceland and Canada, very much have been shaped by the catching of cod, and immense quantities of them. Also, tuna, various species, occur in the open ocean throughout the world, immense quantity of them, and have shaped also cultures, for example, the Mediterranean cultures. They are extremely well-studied species, and we never gonna know more about any single species than we know about Atlantic cod. And we exploit fish throughout the world, knowing much less than we have known about cod. So that's what they have in common. The major difference is that the experiment we conduct with fish, and it is a large experiment, which is, can we collapse them? Can we collapse fish? Has brought fruit with cod? We can. And this has been the case for the major stocks of cod in the North Atlantic, notably in off New England, off Canada, and many stocks in around the North Sea, for example, in the Kattegat. They are reduced at 1-3% of the original abundance, and people are arguing still about continuing to fish them instead of rebuilding them. And the collapse have happened in spite of all this knowledge that we had, that we thought we had on them. The question then is, are we going to do the same thing with the tunas? And there is at least one species or one population of a species, you will hear more from Barbara Block about this, where this is, we're close to it, that is the giant that spawned in the Gulf of Mexico. There is also an enormous spawning area and juvenile area in a so-called triangle in between the Philippines, Indonesia, and Papua New Guinea. And this enormous triangle is fished extensively with a aggregation device, tuna aggregation device, which enable the capture of juveniles. And Jose Ingles will talk about this. This is an area of the world where the trend could be reversed that has affected the fisheries on this species. And I would conclude, because I'm serving only as the one who present the introduction, I would conclude with saying that on land we have actually known to reverse the decline of the iconic species, which was exploited for its ivory, which is much more valuable than sushi for that matter. And by banning the trade of ivory, the elephants was could bounce back. Lots of initiative were needed on the ground to do that. And we need to do that for the tunas, and especially for bluefin, which are in bad shape, and similar to elephants, require active intervention to not go the same way that cod have gone. I'm done.
Thank you very much. Barbara.
I'm Barb Block, and I'm from Stanford University, and I study tunas and large open sea fish. Giant tuna are magnificent animals, long renowned for their large size and transoceanic migrations. The three species of bluefin are the pinnacle of bony fish evolution. They have a unique capacity to maintain warm bodies like a mammal or bird while traversing frigid seas. Their biology has led to apex predator status, safe at the top of the food web, safe until our generation took notice of them. Bluefin have been fished sustainably by man for millennia. Their flesh built civilizations surrounding the Mediterranean. Their images graced Roman and Phoenician coins over 2,000 years ago. They were revered by another generation of humans. But today, they're sought on an industrial scale by sushi connoisseurs who savor the bluefin's delicate flavor and ruby red muscles. Fishermen are compensated the price of a year at Stanford University, $45,000, for a single fish in what has become known as the sushi economy. In the North Atlantic, recent scientific data confirms there are at least two populations of bluefin tuna, one that breeds in the Gulf of Mexico and the other in the Mediterranean Sea. When I was born almost 50 years ago, bluefin that swam from Boston shore to the spawning ground in the Gulf of Mexico had not yet been exploited. The bluefin's myoglobin-rich muscles did not suit our Yankee palates. They were virgin and unfished. In contrast to the Med with its 3,000 years of bluefin fishing, these giants swam free in 1950. These two giants, who were over 600 pounds when at 12 to 14 years of age they spawned for the first time, lived for over 30 years. And today, the genes of these giants still swim in the third or fourth generation offspring in the Gulf of Mexico tuna today, but their population is on the brink of collapse. It has happened on our watch in my lifetime. The U.S. commercial fishers can no longer find bluefin, and we've not been able to catch our restrictive quota the past three fishing seasons. Now, to study bluefin is very difficult. Their size and vast movement across the high seas make it hard to find them. Our team has pioneered electronic tagging to map the travels and behaviors of the elusive bluefin, and we're close to catching and tagging the thousandth giant with an electronic tag after spending many years chasing them at sea. Tagging and genetic data from our program reveal that bluefin in the North Atlantic fishery are indeed composed of two populations unique in their migrations, genetics, and life history. We've tracked eastern fish flocking to the western Atlantic, like European tourists enjoying a favorable exchange on the dollar. And we've seen less frequently our Gulf fish going over to European shores. Genetics document separate Atlantic bluefin tuna populations, yet tagging indicates significant mixing exists across the North Atlantic in productive foraging zones. The Central Atlantic, once thought to be a no man's land that separated the western and eastern fisheries, is actually a hotspot for fish and fishermen alike. International longliners have slammed both populations there during the past decade. Due to the mixing of bluefin from west to east and east to west, the rampant overfishing in the East Atlantic and Mediterranean threatens not only the future of the eastern population, but impacts greatly the western population. We need eastern fishing to come down to ensure the future of both fisheries. Importantly, eastern fish swimming in our western waters are artificially inflating the estimates of the remaining western giants, adding a subsidy. Recent science reveals we're not letting the western bluefin reach maturity and reproduce in the Gulf of Mexico. Immense overfishing in international fisheries in the Atlantic and Med, and continued bycatch of bluefin in the closed Gulf of Mexico spawning area has precipitated the slow rebuilding of our rarer Gulf of Mexico stock of bluefin. Recruitment of the Gulf of Mexico stock is failing. Young bluefin are increasingly hard to find along our North American coast. Technological advances and improvements in our understanding of the life history of bluefin increasingly have shown us that we can actually make precise effort controls with superb spatial units, and yet the policy challenge of preventing overfishing has still to be overcome. Like cod, bluefin have shaped human culture in the marine ecosystem, and like cod, we have eaten them to death. But unlike cod, we have the science in hand today to rebuild bluefin tomorrow. The question is whether managers at home and abroad have the will to act fast enough. Prudent management measures implemented now based on robust science can bring about a resurgence of bluefin tuna, preventing them from going the way of the cod. Thank you.
Jose. I'm Jose Inglis, tuna strategy leader for the Coral Triangle Program of the World Wildlife Fund. This study highlights the issue of high volume of juvenile yellowfin and big-eyed tunas taken by the fishery in the Coral Triangle countries that include Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and up to Fiji, creating ecological, economic, and social impacts on the people that depend on this fishery. For some less understood reason, the juveniles of these two species form schools with skipjack tuna of similar sizes. As a consequence of this behavior, an estimated total of 247,000 tons, or equivalent to about 16%, of the entire skipjack catch are taken as bycatch by this fishery. The revenues generated from the sale of these juveniles are a mere $231 million. A small amount compared to about $1.5 billion if we let these juvenile tunas grow to mature sizes. This translates to a potential loss of $1.2 billion in 2006 alone. The situation is far more serious in coastal fisheries where juvenile tuna catch of Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, and the Philippines combined produces an additional 254,000 metric tons. The volume of juvenile tunas has increased sixfold since 1980. This increase is mainly attributed to the increasing use of and dependence to fish aggregation devices. These are floating structures set at sea that effectively attract these tunas, making them very easy to catch. The use of these structures is recommended. One of the main reasons for its popularity is it was the recommended solution to minimize dolphin-related deaths associated with this fishery in the U.S. In addition, the high cost of fuel have forced fishers to use these devices to save on cost, while the growing scarcity of tunas in the nearshore areas have forced poor fisher folks to effectively herd the few remaining fish at sea. The highly migratory and transboundary nature of these two tuna species adds to the complexity of coming up with a simple solution. All throughout its life stage, as it swims from jurisdiction of one country to the next, these tunas are exploited by poor fisher folks. Because they stay only at a very short period of time, there is an incentive to take as much as possible, irrespective of their size or whether they're legal or illegal. The solution proposed here is for the Coral Triangle countries to form themselves into small tuna groups, acting independently to develop a combination of resource and market-based solutions designed to complement the work of regional management offices. It has been started in the region, for example, with Indonesia and the government of the Philippines looking at the creation of transboundary marine peace parks, whose goal is to protect the critical life stages of these tunas, particularly the spawning nursery as well as their migratory routes. Using these initial conservation investments, these governments could use these good intentions to rally consumers and markets to support development of incentive schemes to help support, raise funds to compensate for losses arising from protecting the juveniles and to support the management of tuna resources. However, key to the solution is to find market countries that are willing to reform the management of tunas. This is a difficult task, and we are treading on new solutions we know very little about. We could not wait, however, for the regional management organization to act on the issue of catching juvenile tunas. We could not let history of the cut repeat itself in this region. Thank you.
Rashid.
You've just heard a podcast that came out of a meeting at the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in which a panel of experts gathered to speak about mismanagement of tuna, particularly as it's in such high demand by the sushi industry. On that panel of experts was UBC's Daniel Pauly, and you also heard Barbara Block as well as Jose Ingles in that excerpt from the podcast. I won't be playing all of it today, but if you want to follow up on that or any other of UBC's collection of podcasts, you can do that by checking out /ubcpodcasts.blogspot.com. Or also an easy way to get to it is www.ubc.ca/podcasts. And there's quite a lot of great things to listen to there. Some of them sciencey, others not so much, but certainly worth investigating. We've got a little bit of time left in the show today, and what I do want to get into right now is another little bit about humor, another little experiment that was comparing the male and female editions of us human folk and how we respond to cartoons or how we tend to respond to humor. One of those studies looked at comparing male and female brains and argued that the women enjoys cartoon, women enjoy cartoons more, and they feel more of a reward for a funny joke. And this study actually proposes a neurological difference in sense of humor between men and women. Alan Rice, Ayman Azim, and colleagues of Stanford University School of Medicine used MRI to study the brains of men and women who were looking at cartoons. Each subject was shown two cartoons and was then asked to compare their funniness. This took place while undergoing MRI to identify the active areas of their brains. Although men and women agreed on which of the two cartoons was actually the funniest, women appeared to have a lower expectation of reward, or a lower expectation that the image would amuse them. So fickle us women folk. So, in effect, if the joke's punchline worked for them, they were more pleased. Lower expectation, greater reward. That kind of reasoning. Men and women could agree on which cartoons were funny or unfunny, just like I said, and the time that it took for them to get the punchline, to get the joke, was also similar between men and women. They also shared many similarities in the regions of their brains that were activated, and those were always the language process regions. But the difference that these researchers detected rested in the reward center of the brain. The nucleus accumbens, part of the mesolimbic reward center, is a dopamine-rich area that is most strongly activated when a reward, or a joke in this case, is unexpected. The reward region was more active when women found a cartoon funny than for men, and this suggested that their expectation of humor was lower. In contrast, men typically showed deactivation in this region when a cartoon was unfunny, suggesting disappointment. The researchers suggest that these differences may reflect different ways in processing emotion, and that study of these mechanisms, males and females' response to humor, may shed light on mental illness, particularly those diseases that affect one gender more than another.
You run it up the brush.
On April 17th, 18th, and 19th, Vivo Media Art Center and CITR 101.9 FM present Signal and Noise. Currently in its ninth year, Signal and Noise is a laser blast of sonic dissonance, video trickery, primed to drag your electronic brain kicking and screaming into a new realm of media art. Based on the theme of media intercourse, Signal and Noise features artists from all over the globe. Each evening presents three elements: a diffusion segment where the audience can sit or lie down within a circle of eight speakers and listen to compelling compositions. Next, festival participants can mingle amongst a series of installations like Endless Kiss or Sex Noise and various slab works presented by Vivo staff members, or a blanket tent presented by the Scene Rippers. Capping off the festival are a series of live performances by the likes of Robot Cowboy, Ghost Taco, Triptych, Touching Velvet, to name a few. Signal and Noise at the Video in 1965 Main Street, April 17th, 18th, and 19th, brought to you by the Vivo Media Arts Center and CITR 101.9 FM.
So, just as you heard there, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is My Science Project. My name is Anne. We've got a few minutes left in the show, about 10. What I'm going to kick up for you here is a little bit about the events. We rarely have time to really get into the events that are going on in the city. And today we do have time. So here's what's coming up. On Thursday, April 24th, health activist Judy Nursigian, you may have heard of her before, she is the author of a women's health book called Our Bodies, Ourselves. And she'll be in Vancouver to talk about the global reach of this now classic book. The director of the Institute of Gender and Health, Dr. Joy Johnson, will open the evening with a discussion of the advances in women's health research in Canada. The Women's Health Research Network, the Centre for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research, and the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology are proud to sponsor this event. Guests can attend in person or over the internet via a live webcast. So that's on April 24th, 2008, from 6:30 to 10 p.m. at the Peetzold Auditorium, Vancouver General Hospital. It's free, but space is limited. There's another event coming up on Friday, April 11th. Genome BC is pleased to invite BC's research community to attend its 6th annual Genomics Forum. This is an opportunity to learn more about the scope, scale, and progress of genomics, proteomics, and bioinformatics research in BC. This is a one-day scientific forum, and it brings together researchers from all aspects of BC's life sciences sector to share information and discuss opportunities for future collaborations. So for more information about that, go to www.genomebc.ca. And that's Friday, April 11th at the Frederick Wood Theatre at UBC. Some of the confirmed speakers for that event are Dr. Barbara Wold, who's principal investigator of the Wold Lab at Caltech, bioinformatics expert. Also, UBC's Professor Stephen Ward, who is the director of UBC's School of Journalism. Also, Dr. Jeffrey Duk, who is managing director of TPG Biotech. Dr. Lawrence Fritz, president and CEO of Covella Pharmaceuticals. And Dr. Robert Watterson, who's professor and chair of genome sciences, University of Washington. So quite an extraordinary panel of guests at that event. Also, Science World has got a new event opening up, and that's called Planet Oz, Walk on Australia's Wild Side. And that opens on April 4th, which is tomorrow. You can go on down to Science World to learn about some of Australia's amazing and unique wildlife at Planet Oz. You'll be able to walk through different Australian ecosystems, learn how some of the world's most amazing creatures adapted to their natural environment, what they eat, and how they live, and how they continue to survive today. It's everything from little koala bears and wallabies to carnivorous, aggressive Tasmanian devils, the laughing kookaburra, the little penguins, the marine life of the Great Barrier Reef. You'll feel like you're in Australia. So go on down. That is Planet Oz, Walk on Australia's Wild Side. So what I'm going to give to you now is a fairly recent album from Eamon Tobin called The Foley Room. I'm really enjoying it these days. This is The Killer's Vanilla. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to my science project today. Coming up next is Darren and Stereoscopic Readout. I'm going to leave you with a little more Eamon Tobin in honor of the big tunas that we heard about and their plight. This is Horsefish.
Thank you.